I was 16 years old when my first girlfriend invited herself over while my parents were visiting friends in Toronto for a week. I had the house completely to myself, apart from the presence of our two cats. The reason for her visit was clear to both of us, although we did not speak of what would happen. I had created low expectations for myself. My older brother had once told me that the first time would be over as soon as started. Sex only gets better after you have practiced, he explained to me when I had carefully asked him as a 13-year-old, because I didn't dare to discuss such things with my parents. It was 3 years later when the moment finally arrived. I had carefully planned everything. The two condoms that I got from a friend were discreetly hidden in the cupboard next to my bed. The bed was nicely made up, and I had even prepared some tea lights. My girlfriend was 15-year-old Lisa, a shy girl who would grow up to be a popular beauty far beyond my own standard. Yet at the time, her form was still modest, and the mild acne on her face concealed her ogling beauty. I was nevertheless as in love as any teenage boy could be. Whilst we were both naked in our bed, a little clumsy and insecure about our awkward bodies, Lisa asked if I wanted to close the curtains. Not that anyone could see us from the lower boulevard. It was an ice-cold evening, and the boulevard was deserted, but the idea of possible onlookers made her nervous. I stood up and walked to the window, where my attention was immediately drawn to a sinister figure on the quay. The house in which I grew up had a view of a large lake in northern British Columbia, and although the village itself was nothing special, it was often flooded with tourists and anglers during the summer. During the rest of the year, on the other hand, it was a sleepy village where the wooden wharf that ran for a few miles along the lake was occasionally used by people who let their dogs out. The majority of the 400 people who lived here were pensioners or young parents who had left the city due to lack of money or other necessities. The dull view of the lake was as natural as everything else in my mundane life. Perhaps that is why the strange shadow that I saw standing on the edge of the pier alarmed me right away. Later, I would learn that I was the fifth to see the Virgin of the Boulevard. I had never heard of the legend until half a year later, when I read about her in a thin book written by a certain Frank Wojcik, which I had stumbled upon in a Vancouver library. The book itself was mediocre, and Wojcik's oeuvre barely extended further than some local urban legends across Alaska and the surrounding area. But nevertheless, he was, apart from some small newspapers, the only source who wrote about the Virgin of the Boulevard, a name that was only used by a few inhabitants of my village. Only 5 times does the Virgin seem to have been spotted. The best described observation is that of a tourist who took an evening stroll along the boulevard in late July 1970 and began to shout so loudly that 4 neighbours came out of their houses to help the poor soul. He only calmed down after an injection in the hospital. The man told the staff there that he had seen a young woman wearing a white dress, the most bizarre detail being her blood-soaked crotch. He had asked her if she was hurt or something, to which she had not answered. When he approached her, he claimed that his memory had been erased. This incident was documented in no more than 20 lines in a local newspaper. I found the article in an archive after a short period of intensive research in my early 20s. The writer Wojcik writes of the origin of the legend, which in my eyes is even more lurid than the observations that supposedly have given every individual that saw her a certain form of post-traumatic stress. In 1956, a dance party for high school students was held in a diner in the centre of town. Around 11 o'clock in the evening, Diane Cope walked home along the boulevard after visiting the party. Originally, the plan was for her to be picked up by her date that evening, a boy named Charlie Seymour, though a fight between the two lovers made Charlie angrily drive away in his coughing Ford. forcing 16-year-old Diane to walk the 2 miles to her house all by herself. On the boulevard, fate struck when 4 drunken young Marines passing through the village could not control themselves and started harassing the teenage girl. One of the Marines must have started pulling at her dress, after which she, stiffened with fear, was beaten and eventually abused. The actual cause of death could no longer be found, since her body was heavily affected by the cold water, so it was difficult to say whether she was murdered during or after the abuse of her body. It was a 10-year-old child who found her body 2 days later in a riverbank a few miles from town. Despite the horrible state of the body, it was clear that she was beaten, and the bruises around her crotch and the incisions in her vaginal walls indicated a forceful rape. The young Marines were eventually tracked down by some ingenious police detective that was flown in from another county. After a long and arduous process, however, the Marines were all acquitted for lack of evidence. Not long after, Diane's parents left the village to mourn in peace. Charlie, torn apart by guilt, sunk into a deep depression. It was Charlie who first saw her spirit on the spot at the boulevard where his girlfriend had died. Logically, his statement was dismissed by the police as a result of his inability to channel his guilt and grief over the tragic loss. According to Charlie, he immediately felt the strong feeling that the young woman he immediately recognized was not the Diane he knew. She was wearing the same dress she had worn on her last evening, a white gown her grandmother had bought for her. It was only when Charlie felt her cold arms and recoiled with fright that he saw the dark red bloodstain that had formed underneath her belly. With tears in his eyes, he had asked her what she was doing here, how this was possible. Diane didn't answer his question, but had slowly lifted her dress instead. Then he screamed until everything around him went black. He woke up in his bed the next day. The incident was seen as an understandable but nevertheless worrying development in his grieving process, and Charlie was taken out of school and brought to a Victoria institution that cared for traumatized children. However, as Frank Wojcik confirms in his book, Charlie insisted until his early death in 1968 that what he had seen was not a hallucination triggered by grief, but something that actually happened. Strikingly enough, the following sighting of the ghost of the boulevard took more than 2 decades. Actually, only after all the people who knew the horrible history of that site had left the sleepy town, or had simply died. It was 1983 when a boy from California, who was out fishing on the lake with his family, claimed he had seen a sinister figure standing on the quay. This source is somewhat debatable, and even Wojcik admits in his book that this observation is in no way verifiable. Less than 2 months later, a young couple that had just moved to the city saw a young woman in a white dress from the bedroom window of their newly purchased apartment looking over the lake. Years later, the couple would report to Wojcik in a short interview that the wife told her husband to go and see what was going on with the young lady outside. She wondered why she was waiting out there in the dark, not wearing proper clothing to protect her against the cold. But she emphasized that she had given her goosebumps and made her change her mind. She had asked her husband to close the window and not pay any further attention to it. Wojcik reports that the woman said this with a hint of pride, as if, with her coldness, she had saved her husband from a major mistake. I want to emphasize that I had none of the foreknowledge as I describe here when I saw the Virgin of the Boulevard standing on the quay that cold November night when I thought I would lose my own virginity. Shivers ran down my bare back as the girl stood still in the darkness. The haunting image of the white dress in the darkness of that harsh winter night did not seem to be right, and I did not even hear Lisa asking me what I was looking at, because I seemed to be mesmerized. I only heard the wind howling, and I imagined how cold the young woman must feel in that fluttering dress. The harsh weather that night required you to wear gloves and a winter coat at the minimum. I narrowed my eyes and tried to distinguish the features of her face, but in the darkness I only saw contours. It was as if she beckoned me, even though she wasn't moving. That was perhaps the creepiest thing about the scene, that she was motionless, and only her wavy black hair and dress moved in the wind. I called Lisa to the window, and she hesitantly stood up while covering her breasts with her hands. When she saw the figure, she gasped. "Who is that?" she asked in a soft voice. I replied that I did not know. "She must be ice cold. Why is she standing there?" asked Lisa, while I wondered the same things. "I'll take a look," I replied, more confidently than I really felt. If I had been honest with myself, the idea frightened me, but I could not help but see if everything went well with her. I dressed myself again and told Lisa to wait under the covers. "I'll be right back," I said firmly. I wrapped myself in my sturdy jacket and walked out the door. The wind was strong, and the only thing I heard was the muffled sounds of the waves breaking against the shore. The girl was no further away than 30 yards, but even when I approached her and carefully raised my hand, she did not move. When I stood about a few feet away from her, I asked what happened to her. She looked at me with a cold look, her red-stained lips still pressed tightly together. I saw that she had an appearance that was somewhat reminiscent of the Aboriginal people who had given up on the Canadian government, and many of whom had been left to fend for themselves in reserves. Her eyes were dark, but her skin was light. A half-blood, I thought. When I repeated the question for the third time, she carefully lifted the sides of her white dress with her thin fingers. Even before I could stop her, she showed me her battered crotch. What I saw triggered a wave of nausea in me. The inside of her thighs was stained with huge bruises, and everything around her vulva was covered in blood. The blood had partly dried up and stuck to her dark pubic hair. I turned my eyes away and looked into her eyes. The last thing I remember are the tears, because they sparkled in the dark. I can still feel the fear that came over me at that moment, the fear that was so powerful that it swallowed me up. The next moment I woke up in my bed, Lisa on a chair by my side, crying. I had been gone for 5 hours, and in the comatose state I was in, the kind-hearted Lisa had tried to wake me up in every possible way, and searched the entire house for a number where she could reach my parents without success. I told Lisa in a trembling voice what had happened, what a terrible thing I had seen. I asked her what happened to the girl, but she only soothed me and encouraged me to eat the sandwich she had prepared for me. Lisa made up an excuse and told her parents that I had a strong flu. She took care of me all weekend. She told me that I probably had a hallucination. Maybe it had been cold, she said, because when I was still not back after 10 minutes, she had looked out the window and saw me lying on the pier. There was no trace of the figure in the white dress. I knew for sure that I had not hallucinated, that what I had seen was real, but in my state of confusion and shock, I had neither the desire nor the power to fight Lisa. Initially, the incident strengthened our relationship. The fright bound us, and that Sunday we lost our virginity in my warm bed. A childhood love followed, like all others, turbulent, full of communication errors and uncertainty. But the inevitable end came even faster than I expected. It probably had a lot to do with my slight fascination with the boulevard. Lisa said I should stop thinking about the incident. In the end, she wasn't even sure if she had really seen the girl through the window. "Maybe it was something else, something our nervous minds had fabricated," she said. But I knew better. From that particular evening, I had developed a fear for the possible return of the young girl in the white dress. I tried to rationalize the incident for my own health, to put it away as a product of my overactive imagination. When my parents were back, I decided to keep the whole incident to myself. They wouldn't believe me, at least not the last part. I am now 34, and in all the years I have never seen her again. In my nightmares, sometimes, but never in the town. I now feel that I am the only one who is still interested in the legend of the Virgin of the Boulevard. Perhaps there is a certain comfort in the idea that Diane has stopped terrorizing the townsfolk. Maybe, somehow, she found the peace she deserves, there in the cold lake where she was dumped. And yet, the yearning, excited boy in me is still hoping for a reunion. Although I'm not old yet, I feel tired. The house that I bought together with my wife, I chose specially because it is close to the lake. And for years I spent about half an hour a day in front of the front window, my eyes focused on the quay, longing for a glimpse of her, of Diane, the Virgin of the Boulevard. My wife knows about it. I told her everything just before our wedding night. She has tolerated my fascination for a long time, although in her eyes it was always an obsession. But this year she had enough, and after 15 years in that creaking house on the quay, I have to admit that the idea of a new home in the city seems attractive to me as well. If my wife had not enforced it, I would have kept on watching over the bay in my lazy chair. But now that I have finally resigned myself of this task, I know she is right. Now I am looking forward to the idea of living in a lively city, where the streets are crowded with people and my daughter has a promising future. It is the opposite of the place I have lived so long in. Yet I have to say that such a new existence seems almost surreal. The idea of being far away from that quay which is still contaminated by the evil deed that took place all those years ago. Our house was sold to an older couple from Boston. I didn't say a word about Diane or the form in which she appeared. Why would I? I don't want to expose them to such a horrible, forgotten story. I know the quay like no other. I spent so many hours staring at the swirling water. I know the lamp posts, which come on right at 6 o'clock, whatever the season. I know the cold, white light that leaves a spooky glow on the wooden pier as night falls. I know the rounds of the nocturnal walkers and the people who walk their dogs at punctual times. I know that every now and then a fat black rat shows up. His fur is often still wet from the sewer from which he crawled. But I never saw her again, and I never will. Tomorrow I will leave this house, and that day I will bury the memory of the Virgin of the Boulevard. This story is released under an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0 International Creative Commons license. This story was narrated by Peter Yearsley. It was written by A Darker Tale. Follow A Darker Tale on Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.